we'll bring Senate Business and Labor to order. Will the Secretary take the roll?
Vice Chair Vance?
Here.
Vice Chair Boland?
Here.
Senator Ellsworth?
Excused.
Senator Fox?
Here.
Senator Gauthier?
Present.
Senator Gillespie?
Here.
Senator Pope?
Here.
Senator Small?
Here.
Senator Smith?
Excused.
Senator Sweeney?
Here.
Chairman Fitzpatrick?
Here.
All right. Good morning, committee. We've got five bills today. I know some people have to jump in and out. That's fine. Go ahead and leave if you've got other commitments. So we'll start with Senate Resolution 92, and we'll turn over to Senator Vance.
Okay, members of the committee, Senate Resolution 92 is where we start today. Senator Fitzpatrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Steve Fitzpatrick, Senate District 10. The next resolution I have for you is Senate Resolution 92. This is an appointment by the governor to the State Electrical Board, and I hope I don't mispronounce the name, but the appointment by the governor is Derek Hadeland from Townsend. We have his resume here in the folder with you. You can see that he is an electrician. He's been a journeyman electrician and is also the owner and president of Green Source Electric in Townsend. And with that, I will sit down and listen to the proponents. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Fitzpatrick. Proponents to Senate Resolution 92.
Good morning, Mr. Vice Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Leanne, L-I-A-N-E Taylor, T-A-Y-L-O-R, representing the governor's office, and Mr. Hedlund, I think you've got his resume and everything. The board itself is made up of five members, and two of the members are licensed electricians. One member has to be a master licensed electrical contractor, and then there's also two members of the board. And these terms are 5 years, and the terms of their office are arranged so that one term expires on July 1st of each year. And I think Mr. Hedlund will come up next. There's some other proponents. Abby St. Lawrence, representing the Montana Building Industry Association, was not able to make it, but also wanted to lend their support. And with that, we, which is the governor's office, would ask for your support and the confirmation of Mr. Hedlund. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Further proponents?
Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Derek Hedlund, H-E-D-A-L-E-N. I live in Townsend, Montana. I'm honored to be here today and appreciate your consideration of my appointment to the Montana State Electrical Board. I grew up in Broadwater County and currently live in Townsend. I started Green Source Electric in 2015, and I've been growing my business and expanding my employee base ever since. I employ apprentices, journeymen, and master electricians. I'm also a licensed pilot and a Montana licensed hunting and fishing guide. I would like to be part of the board because I think it is critical that we closely evaluate apprenticeship ratios and work to do everything in our power to ensure we can offer more opportunities to apprentices and have a thriving electrical workforce in the state of Montana. I'm passionate about the training for electricians and enjoyed talking to students about the electrical industry. I would like to represent independent contractors and bring balance to this board. Over 70% of electricians in Montana are trained by independent contractors. This is indicative of the market share. I currently sit on the board for the Helena Building Industry Association, and I am a member of the Montana Independent Electrical Contractors. I take pride in electrical trade, and I'm thankful for my career. I look forward to the opportunity to serve the state of Montana, and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Further proponents?
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, my name is Margaret Morgan, M-O-R-G-A-N. I'm here today on behalf of the Montana Independent Electrical Contractors, also known as Montana IEC. We support the confirmation of Derek Hedlund to the State Electrical Board. The State Electrical Licensure Board greatly affects the work and lives of master and journeyman electricians in Montana. Mr. Hedlund will be a positive addition to the board, particularly in this time of working to improve and increase our workforce. He will bring a badly needed balance to the board, and we appreciate your support of his confirmation. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there further proponents? Are there any proponents in the hallway?
Are there any proponents?
Let's see, three total. So if you've done three, that's it.
Okay, are there any proponents on Zoom? Okay. Are there any opponents to SR 92?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Luke Hoffer, H-O-F-F-E-R. I represent the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 233. We are opposing this appointment because the electrician is a journeyman electrician and not a master electrician. This position is being appointed is supposed to be a master licensed electrical contractor in accordance with MCA 2.15.164. Thank you, and please oppose this appointment and ask the governor to appoint a master electrician. Thank you.
Thank you. Further opponents?
Hello, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Keith Allen, A-L-L-E-N, and I'm representing myself. I'm a master electrician. I was my dad and grandfather, my brother, my son-in-law, my uncle, and a cousin. It's just what we do. My grandpa was on the first state electrical board. He was the first licensed electrician in the state holding master number one. And I've been lucky enough to attend the electrical board meetings for 23 years since 1998. I've only missed, I think, maybe four of them. There's two types of electrical contractors in Montana, limited and unlimited. Limited electrical contractors can only perform residential work. They have a journeyman electrician as their responsible electrician. Unlimited electrical contractors can perform all electrical work, and they have a master electrician as their responsible electrician. An unlimited electrical contractor is what's known under MCA 215-1764 as a master licensed electrical contractor, which SR 92 covers. That position has always been the responsible master electrician of an unlimited electrical contractor. It's never been the owner or an employee of a master licensed electrical contractor, to my knowledge. If it were, then you could have an accountant, apprentice, or even a parts runner employed by a master licensed electrical contractor be appointed to this position. That's a very slippery slope if that's what we're going to start doing. I'm opposing this appointment because the electrician doesn't meet the statutory requirements of the position. 215-1764-2 states, in part, two members of the board shall represent the public, two members of the board shall be licensed electricians, one member shall be a master licensed electrical contractor. The other two electricians that are already on the board are a journeyman and a master. One works for a company he doesn't own. One is employed as a state electrical inspector. Mr. Hedlund is only a journeyman electrician. He does own and is employed by his own company, though, but his responsible master electrician resides in Nevada. He's not a master electrician, doesn't meet the qualifications for this appointment, so please vote no on this appointment and ask the governor to appoint a responsible master for a master licensed electrical contractor. Thank you.
Thank you. Further opponents? Seeing none in the building, are there any opponents on Zoom? Okay, are there any informational witnesses on Zoom? Okay, questions from the committee? Senator Pope.
Yeah, I just have a quick question for the sponsor. Mr. Chair, Senator Fitzpatrick, could you clarify and clear up for us, are we running into problems with the MCA on this nomination?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pope, could I refer this to Ms. Taylor? She can probably answer the question better than I can.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Taylor?
Redirect, Mr. Chair. Ms. Taylor, we are hearing that the nominee doesn't fit the requirement. Could you please clarify for us?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pope, so the... Oh, is it off? Oh, okay. Mr. Senator Small. So the code or the position is for a master licensed electrical contractor. Mr. Hedlund's license is attached to that, so that does clarify or that does cover that position.
Senator Pope.
Thank you very much.
Further questions? Senator Sweeney.
Ms. Taylor, one more time before you leave. So when you say he meets that qualification, is that because he's got a master's electrician employed with him, but that we heard that electrician was in Nevada? Is that what qualifies him, is because he has a master's that works for his company?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sweeney, I would probably redirect that to Mr. Hedlund with okay. the chair's permission.
That'll be fine. Thank you.
Mr. Hedlund.
Mr. Hedlund, Mr. Chair, I'm just kind of following up on Senator Post. You heard the discussion there. So to meet the qualifications, it's my understanding that you had to have a master's electrician to be appointed to this position, and I think they're saying that you're qualified because you employ a master's
Yes, thanks for the question. I believe the position's open for an unlimited electrical contractor, and I am an unlimited electrical contractor in the state of Montana.
So there was nothing in there in your position you don't feel that requires?
No. In fact, after working with Nash Electric for 7 years as a commercial electrician, I was able to open Green Source Electric with Nash's license attached to it, which I'm thankful for the Montana state laws and the electrical board rules that allow me to do so. I'm now enabled to do that. I'm now qualified to take my master's exam and are prepping for it currently. But I am and have since I've gone into business an unlimited electrical contractor, which meets the statute, I think.
So,
Senator Sweeney, follow up.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, follow up. So, did you refer to somebody that is under your employ that's a master that allows you to pursue that? Is that right?
Under the state law, you can lease someone's master's license to attach to your business to become an unlimited electrical contractor. So there's several businesses in the state that do that, and it's with Montana state law that allows that to happen. So in doing that, I've been an unlimited contractor, not a limited contractor, which would be just a journeyman-based business. Those limited contractors are only allowed to do residential work. I'm an unlimited contractor. We perform lots of commercial, industrial, and residential work in the state of Montana.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
So the person that you have your license attached to with the master's, are they currently working, or are they retired, or are they out of state?
Yes. Yeah, so I as an apprentice in 2007, during the recession, I wasn't able to reside a job to get a job as an apprentice here in Montana. So 18 in high school, I went to work for Gerald Nash Electric, who was in Helena. And that then moved me to Las Vegas, Nevada, where his son, Pat Nash, employed me down in Nevada for 3 years during my apprenticeship. I was fortunate. My fourth year, I was able to move home with the same company and perform my last year of the apprenticeship here in Helena, back in my hometown area. I then grew with the company and was a foreman, and they decided to not want to do the business in Montana anymore, so that's when we struck a deal, and I use his license to become an unlimited electrical contractor, which is legal through the laws and rules in Montana.
Thank you.
Senator Sweeney, is that...
That's it. No
okay.
questions.
Senator Boland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question for Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, Senator Boland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Taylor, Mr. Hedlund just referenced to rules and state law that he is an unlimited electrical contractor. Can you please get us that MCA code or rule that says that? I don't have the rule book here in front of me, and I don't have time to look it up. Could you get that information to us, please?
I will. Or, Mr. Chair, Senator Boland, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Pope, are you back on?
Just one question for, if I might, Mr. Chair, for Ms. Morgan, the independent electric contractors.
Ms. Morgan, Senator Pope.
Mr. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Ms. Morgan. I just wanted to ask you to clarify and expound on your statement that this nomination will bring, and I'm going to quote you, bring badly needed balance to the board. Would you tell us what that means?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator. In Montana, as in every state, there are independent electrical contractors who are known as merit shop or non-union electrical contractors. And then you have your electrical contractors. The merit shop independent electrical contractors train 72% of all apprentices in the state of Montana, and which is indicative of the market share that independent electrical contractors do in the state of Montana. The state electrical board has long been controlled, or the majority of the votes are by union contractors, and as I mentioned in my testimony as well, this licensing board greatly affects the lives and work of electrical contractors and journeymen and masters. And we have been wanting and applying for independent electrical contractors to be appointed to this board for many years because of the large market share that we have and the large number of apprentices that we train, by far the majority. So this is an important appointment to bring balance to the board, to have representation on that board, which we have not had for many, many years.
Senator Paul.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Follow-up.
Ms. Morgan, thank you. You know, we're trying to catch up on the different slots that are in this board, and I apologize, and I'll stand corrected, but did I not hear just a few minutes ago that there is a journeyman slot on the board currently, or am I mishearing that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pope, there is a... Ms. Taylor read the makeup of the board. There's so many journeymen, master, and two public members, and there currently is a master on the board. So, and two journeymen. And so this appointment fits in easily within the requirements of the board.
Senator, pardon me, Ms. Chair, I'll follow up on that. My point, Ms. Morgan, was you just said that we need to bring badly needed balance to the board. And what my point was that there are journeymen on the board, and you just confirmed that. And I'm just trying to square your comment why this board is out of balance in paraphrasing your testimony to us.
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator Pope, I do, and you are a little bit misunderstanding what I mean by balance. So,
thank you. Go ahead and please tell us what you mean by balance. Thank you.
Yes, the balance that I'm talking about is the balance between independent electrical contractors, or independent electrical representation, and union representation. And for many, many years, the majority on the electrical board has been union representation. And yet, independent electrical contractors for many, many years have been doing the majority of the electrical work in the state, and and training the majority of the apprentices. So that is the balance we are talking about, not the balance of journeyman and master, but the balance of independent electrical contractors who do the majority of the work and union work in the state. And the board has been long dominated by the union, and therefore many of the issues that come before the board are not fairly or equally considered, because oftentimes you do have issues that are union versus non-union on that board. So this appointment would help bring some balance along those lines. Does that answer your question, Senator Pope?
I very much appreciate your taking the time to tell us, Ms. Morgan. Thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you for your time.
Further questions from the committee? Senator Boland, you have another.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one more quick question for Luke Hoffer, I believe, with IBEW.
Senator Boland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm sorry, did I get the last name proper? Is it Hoffer or Hofferman?
Hoffer is right.
Hoffer. Okay, thank you, Mr. Hoffer. I just have a quick question in listening to the testimony that we just heard from Ms. Morgan, and that she has said that they do most of the, like I think she said 70% of the training and most of the electrical work in Montana. Can you respond to that for me?
I don't have any figures on that. And I couldn't hear out in the hall exactly what she was saying. So unfortunately, I don't know how to answer that question.
Senator Boland.
Mr. Chairman, if I could re-refer to Keith Allen, if he's still there.
Senator Boland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Allen, I don't know if you heard out in the hallway, but I was asking Mr. Hoffer to comment on Ms. Morgan's testimony that the independent contractors are doing most of the training, and I think she quoted like 70% of the training for the apprentice, and that they do most of the electrical work. Can you respond to that at all?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boland, I was out in the hallway. It's loud. I couldn't hear anything, but as far as work in the state, I know the independent electrical contractors group themselves have about, and I haven't looked at it for a while, but they have about 8% of the contractors in the state. And I don't know, union, non-union shouldn't be involved in the electrical board. But as far as work, the union does about 30%, depending on the area of the state. The IEC, with 8% of the contractors, probably does about the same. And then there's a bunch of contractors that are non-union, but they're not in IBEW or IEC, if that helps.
Yeah, that helps. Thank you very much, Mr. Allen. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions from the committee? Senator Sweeney.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to follow up on Senator Boland's question, too. I believe it was stated that her group trained 70% of the apprentices in the state. Can you respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sweeney, I'm here representing myself today. In the past, I was a trustee on our state, the IBEW and NECA electrical training, our joint apprenticeship and training committee. We're the largest sponsor in the state of Montana for apprentices, because we have a joint labor management. And we have, off the top of my head, about 160 apprentices, but we're the largest apprentice sponsor in the state, single sponsor.
One more follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
So I don't know if you heard the discussion about the relationship between the candidate and that allows him to qualify for this position, but he is training under a master electrician that's out of state. I don't know if you're familiar with that relationship or not, but apparently that's allowed within state law. So they're saying that he's qualified because he's working under a master's electrician. Does that sound right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sweeney, I didn't hear the conversation, but there are out-of-state electrical contractors that do work in Montana, and their master, which is sometimes their owner, but sometimes it's their responsible electrician, might reside in Washington, for instance, and then that company can come here and do a job. There's also a requirement that the responsible electrician has to be a full-time employee. And all that aside, the master electrical license contractor is the position that's being appointed, not just an employee of the unlimited contractor. It needs to be the master electrician, which is the responsible electrician of the master licensed electrical contractor. Mr. Hedlund's just a journeyman.
Thank you. That's all.
Further questions from the committee? Senator Small.
Yes, Ms. Morgan, would you like to clarify that statement or something along that line?
Mr. Vice Chair, Senator, I can easily verify the numbers, question that was brought up. So to clarify, the Independent Electrical Contractors is an association. Not all independent electrical contractors are members of the Independent Electrical Contractor Association. But an easily verifiable number, there are currently 600, this is current numbers, and 84 electrical apprentices in Montana. Independent electrical contractors who are non-union, not all members of mine, train 72% of those, and the union trains 181. So that is an easily verifiable, easily documentable number. And also, it is indicative then, the number of apprentices trained, it is indicative of the number of the market share of electrical work in the state of Montana. So those are verifiable numbers. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Morgan. Further questions from the committee? Senator Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is for Mr. Hedlund. Thank you for coming today. My question I just want to ask, and related to work history, about 8-10 years ago, I've done a lot of electrical work in town here, hiring contractors and commercial-wise and everything else. But I did watch St. Peter's Health go through a major remodel about 8-10 years ago, and it was like a 18-month electrical contract that I knew the contractor. Pretty intensive project. And I'm just trying to kind of base your commercial experience based on what I remember from that project. Do you have any kind of experience that you could explain to me that you've done something like that big a scale work?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Senator Gauthier, for the question. And, you know, Mr. Allen says, I'm just a journeyman electrician. Well, that kind of stabs me in the heart a little bit because, you know, it's been a long road and a passion for me. I've been doing this since a senior year in high school, and I'm now 32 years old. I've done projects, you know, as small as service work to as large as currently we're doing the right now in Big Sky, the new Big Sky bus barn for the school district. I haven't done any big hospitals like that, but I have managed over 10 hotel buildings, three of them here in Helena, Butte, Great Falls, Las Vegas, Fresno, California, all all over the state. So I would say my roundabout experience, you know, is kind of all over the place. And as an electrician, you know, you've got doctors and lawyers that specialize, you know, in certain parts of law or medicine. And electrical works kind of the same way. Some guys specialize in residential. Some guys just go after that commercial real hard. I have a real roundabout experience in all of it, and I've been fortunate enough to have that experience as an electrician and an unlimited electrical contractor.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pope, you have more questions?
I apologize, Mr. Chair. I just have a question and a request, and Mr. Chair, it could be of the committee, of the sponsor, or it could be of Ms. Taylor, but we've had a lot of conversation about, you know, what is this slot? I mean, we have multiple slots on the state electric. I don't have a clue. And instead of all of us having to go figure it out in the MCA, Mr. Chair, I'm just going to ask if someone, the sponsor or Ms. Taylor, could specifically tell us what this slot is and give us some comfort that the nominee fits the slot. Because, you know, I'm sort of out of. I don't want to belabor it, and I apologize for taking so much time, Mr. Chair.
Thank
you. If that's something I could, if you want me to, I can ask Ms. Taylor direct. I think Senator Boland may have already requested that. I just want to make sure that we get the information about what it is we're supposed to be deciding here.
Thank you, Senator Pope. Ms. Taylor, can you clarify things for us?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pope, yes, I will make sure to have that to the committee by this afternoon and hopefully clarify all your questions.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Senator Pope, does that clear it up for you?
We're good. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Seeing none, sponsor care to close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I close.
That closes the hearing on SR 92. Chairman Fitzpatrick.
Thank you. We'll go to House Bill 121. We have the good representative here, so we'll open the hearing on House Bill 121.
Chairman Fitzpatrick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Beattie, representative of House District 86, which is comprised of Hamilton and the immediately surrounding area. I bring for your consideration House Bill 121, which seeks to strike a prudent balance between, on one hand, the authority of local public health officials and that authority that they need in order to perform their duties, and on the other hand, the responsibility that a locally elected governing body bears for the establishment and execution of policy within its jurisdiction. If this relationship is out of balance, it can threaten the legitimacy of public health actions that are so needed to protect the health of all Montanans. Here is a summary of the key components of the bill. Public health regulations are to be approved by a local governing body instead of a board of public health. The authority that public health officials now have to enforce public health regulations remains intact. This is based on a principle that elected officials ought to establish the law and non-elected officials, in this case public health officials, should be enforcing the law that is established by an elected body. The second point I'll make is a board of public health, however, may make rules necessary to implement and enforce the regulations that have been adopted by a local governing board. Another change to the law is that violation of a local rule will be subject to a civil penalty rather than a misdemeanor, which is currently the case. Four, during a declared state of emergency or disaster, public health officials may take immediate action by issuing mandates, directives, or orders, but such actions are subject to subsequent review by the local governing body, which may then amend, rescind, or otherwise change these actions. And finally, during a declared state of emergency or disaster, public health officials may not take actions that interfere with people gathering for religious worship at a church, synagogue, or other place of worship. This prohibition recognizes the significance of a person's spiritual health. Despite the fears expressed by some, this bill does not limit the power of public health officials to enforce public health laws, nor does it prevent public health officials from acting expeditiously during crises when time is of the essence. A close reading of the bill will bear out these assertions. Now, some claim that matters of public health should be left exclusively to the experts because elected officials often lack scientific expertise. But this point of view overlooks the fact that most public policy issues are multifaceted. Our public health officials rightfully focus on our physical health, which is to be expected as this is where their expertise lies. But who is to consider, for example, our spiritual or economic health? Within our constitutionally based republic, elected officials bear the responsibility for taking all factors into account when setting policy and also when emergencies must be managed. HB 121 facilitates the execution of this duty. Now, I will grant that at times elected officials may make judgments that are not universally accepted or that they might even make mistakes, but the same can be said for other officials such as public health officials. And of course, this is part of living in a free society. And under House Bill 121, there are no restrictions on the ability of public health officials to perform their duties, as I mentioned earlier, nor are there any restrictions on public health officials' ability to provide sound advice to the decision makers within their jurisdictions. Mr. Chairman, I have offered in the time since I first got this bill through the House, I discovered a few what I consider to be worthwhile amendments that has been captured in one amendment document, which I believe that you have a copy of now, and I would urge you to consider when you take executive action. These amendments, this amendment has three purposes. It refines the definition of isolation and local governing board, improving those definitions, and it also moves one clause embedded within the bill to, and makes it a whereas clause, as this seems to be the more appropriate place for it to fit within the bill. Mr. Chairman, this concludes my opening remarks on House Bill 121.
Thank you. All right, we'll go to proponents in the hallway for House Bill 121. Go ahead, sir. Go ahead with the proponents. And we do have a lot of proponents, so I'm going to limit everybody to 2 minutes. When you hear the buzzer, please conclude your remarks. So go ahead, sir.
Yeah, I'll be quick. Thanks. My name is Darren Gaub, G-A-U-B. I'm here testifying for myself. I'm a resident of Helena. And it's been my privilege for over 28 years to serve in the military, and one of those things I've done was to lead large organizations composed of thousands of people. And one of the things that was the difference between a good organization and a great organization and then an average organization was the ability to have engaged in accountable leadership. And I know that's not an exact comparison, but in state and local government, leadership matters, and staff advises, and here a public health officer is a staff officer who should be advising elected officials, who in this case would be the leadership, and they make the final decision. Staff typically is very narrow in focus and often unaccountable, such as in this case. Leadership is supposed to have a broader perspective of things and take in all aspects of societal concerns and impacts based on staff recommendations and bring all those staff people together into one single decision for which they can be held accountable. If they're voted for, they're accountable to the people. A public health officer is not accountable to the people and is just one staff officer among many making recommendations and should not be making final decisions. The government works for us, and not us for the government. So I'd ask you to please support House Bill 121. Thank you.
Thank you. Next proponent.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jackson Dupree, last name spelled D-U-P-R-E-Y, and I'm representing myself. I'm here today urging you to support HB 121 because unelected people in the local health departments should be required to receive approval from the local governing for the local government before they institute restrictions that affect people's lives. I agree with the previous speaker when he talked about there needs to be accountability. I agree with that. And this, when they put limits on businesses' capacities or hours they can be open, how does a business like a restaurant operate at 50% capacity? I mean, restaurants only have a 3 to 5% profit margin. The reason I am passionate is because COVID restrictions have affected my life. During my spring break last year, I had college shut down for the rest of the semester. But it doesn't compare to how bad some of these businesses in my own town have been affected by these restrictions. We have checks and balances for our governor. I say it's time we have checks and balances for the health department. Let's pass HB 121 so that unelected health boards and officers have to get approval from local government bodies that are elected by the people. You can vote out elected government officials, but you can't vote out unelected bureaucrats. For all these reasons, vote yes on HB 121. Thank you.
Thank you. Next proponent.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee. Thank you for hearing me. My name is Cindy Roscoe, R-O-S-C-O-E, and I am here as a parent of two daughters that attend East Helena Public Schools. The restrictions that have been placed on this school district have been numerous. The East Helena School Board have done an amazing job of full-time in-person learning. My frustration lies with the Public Health Board. I am very involved with my daughters, going to lunch with each one once a month and playing with them on the playground. I have volunteered my time in the classroom when needed and very much enjoy my time with them. No student awards, no Christmas programs, and no special time with my kids. These have all been eliminated. I know that COVID-19 has claimed many lives, and to all those families, my deepest apologies. Children have the highest survival rate. You don't know you have this virus until symptoms appear. I could say the same thing about the flu. My kids have gone to bed feeling fine and woke up sick the next morning. We have turned our teachers into babysitters and parents into teachers, neither of which is the responsibility of either we wish to have. Just recently, our Governor Gianforte and Senator Daines released restrictions including masks, but the Public Health Board has kept them in place. Abuse of power and constitutional rights of all ages. Thank you.
Thank you. For the proponents, and just proponents, 2 minutes each.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Carolyn Truscott, T-R-U-S-C-O-T-T. This bill is one of the most important bills this session because the boards of health in our state have overstepped their authority. The governor drops the mask mandate, the Board of Health keeps it, and the tug of wars keep going on, and we the people are caught up in it. And frankly, I'm tired of being tugged on. The bottom line is the insanity must stop. Viruses will come and go, but mandates, dictates, rules and laws will go on and on forever. Fortunately, this is one law that is necessary. I support House Bill 121. Thank you.
Thank you. For the proponents.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Susie Shimmin. That's S-H-I-M-M-I-N, and I stand in support of HB 121. On March the 14th of last year, I turned from my trip to Australia just days before the country shut down from COVID. My return to the US was like coming back to a different country. Many were already wearing masks, there was a lot of anxiety and fear, and there were many unknowns about our future. When I arrived in Montana, I had to immediately self-quarantine for 14 days. We experienced a run on food at the supermarkets, people grasping for toilet paper at Costco. Steak was rationed, one package per family. We had to transform how we did our work to virtual platforms. In short, our world was turned upside down. To complicate matters further, we had many of our liberties stripped from us. I could not go to church. My favourite restaurants were closed, and some will never reopen. Schools were closed, and you could see parents struggling, trying to make a living and trying to look after their children. When I went shopping, there was a division between those who wore masks and those who did not. People were upset and got angry. Despite pleas to our local health officer, face masks, which continue to be mandated in Gallatin County, is a divisive policy. Local health boards and officers empowered by the Code of Montana continue to this day to impose restrictions on our behaviour without the oversight of any elected body. In fact, in Gallatin County, public meetings have been relegated to Zoom, so you can't even talk to these unelected bureaucrats in person. As a result, we have been largely shut out from having a voice in decisions that affect our lives, our livelihoods, and our community during this seemingly unending state of emergency. That is flat out wrong. And that is why I support HB 121. It requires that health boards get approval for any action they take that is stricter than the state.
Thank you, ma'am. We're done. 2 minutes. Thank you. Next proponent.
Hello, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Tusken, T-U-S-K-E-N, and I'm here in support of HB 121. Over the past year, we have seen outrageous overreach of our local, state, and federal governments in their overreaction to the coronavirus pandemic. At first, 2 weeks to flatten the curve was reasonable, as was the 30 days to slow the spread. Here we are, one entire year later, with a huge amount of knowledge and understanding of COVID. States across the country have lifted their mask mandates and restrictions with little to no negative effect. And yet our local county health boards are still hanging on to outdated data, pushing non-pharmaceutical interventions that have had no meaningful effect. I have provided dozens of studies and public comments at many health board meetings since the mask mandates went into effect in July, with oppositional studies and research ranging from mask use to prevalence of asymptomatic spread to the lack of evidence that restricting business hours of bars and restaurants will dampen transmission rates, as have many other citizens of Gallatin County. During each meeting, it seems as though the county health board members are not interested in hearing viewpoints from the citizens, how their decisions will impact people's businesses, or the stacks of studies and documentation empirically showing non-pharmaceutical interventions have minimal, if any, effect. Unfortunately, the only recourse for the citizens is to appeal to the legislature to put a check on health boards and rein them in when necessary. It is because of the charts documenting cases in mass versus non-mass populations that I sent to the last county health board meeting that caused our county commissioner sitting on that board to request a discussion and vote at the next meeting to end our mandates. Let's support my county commissioner and give him the tools to give the people their voice back. I urge a due vote. Thank you.
Thank you. Next proponent.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Charlotte Snyder, S-N-Y-D-E-R. I am here representing myself and as a board member of the Freedom Protection Project and thousands of parents with the Montana Family Alliance. I am speaking in support of HB 121. Currently, many of our health department officials do not have the proper degrees to be making the decisions that they are. They have caused a number of other problems because of their response to the pandemic. We have people out of work, suicides are skyrocketing, businesses are being shut down for good. People and businesses are being targeted because they choose not to live in fear. There needs to be more accountability for the actions that have taken place. Elected officials need to be responsible, and local boards should not be creating rules that are more stringent than state regulations. Please stop this overreach and vote yes on HB 121. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Thank you. For the proponents.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eric Bryson. That's B-R-Y-S-O-N. I'm here on behalf of the Montana Association of Counties. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank the sponsor for bringing forward a deliberative and well-thought-out revamping of public health authority. I have said in previous testimony, and I'm going to say it again, in the middle of a pandemic is likely not the best time or most opportune time to talk about restructuring our public health, but we support this bill because of the way that the suggestions have been brought forward and the way that Representative Beattie has included other considerations. I want to talk about specifically the redefinition of local governing body. That was a suggestion that we brought to him early on, and it helps really, even outside of a pandemic, with better clarity on what the organizational structure of is of multiple boards of health across the state, and so we thank him for that. The bill as proposed also has a further clarification about who hires the health officer. It's a little ambiguous in law right now, and so this conforms to really standard practices. But at the end of the day, what the bill really does is put the onus on the local governing body, i.e. elected officials, to do the really difficult work of implementing regulations and rules. We're familiar with that on the county side. We have our boards of health that do the same kind of process and promulgation of rules and regulations that are submitted to boards of county commissioners for review and approval. That's what this bill does. The public health professionals can do the work. They can do the dirty work in-house. They can come up with the regulations, promulgation of rules, and submit to the accountable governing body, i.e. elected officials, for final review and approval. It is a good bill, and we encourage your support. Thank you.
Thank you. For the proponents.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg Dorrington. That's spelled D-O-R-R-I-N-G-T-O-N, here today on behalf of the Montana Medical Association, standing in support of HB 121. I think Eric Bryson did a very good job summarizing a lot of the points I was going to make. This is a challenging time to be revamping our public health system or process, but I would really like to thank Representative Beattie for all the work that he has done on this bill. He has spent hours and hours and hours of time working with stakeholders to come up with this bill, and we think he's struck an acceptable balance, frankly, between the role and authority of public health and that of our elected county officials. At the end of the day, I think we can all recognize community health and business success are really closely related. Companies depend on communities to provide healthy employees, consumers, business partners, and at the same time, communities depend on companies to offer jobs, stability, and income. And in times of emergency, it's really hard to balance those two things, but I think this bill does a pretty good job of trying to do that, outlining a framework where multiple viewpoints and factors can be considered, including the science-based, evidence-based recommendations of that public health department or orders of the public department. And it's done in a transparent way. So for these reasons, we'd ask me for a due concur. And Mr. Chair, I regrettably have a hearing downstairs, so I'd ask to be excused.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you. For the proponents.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Henry Kriegel. That's K-R-I-E-G-E-L with Americans for Prosperity Montana. We stand in support of HB 121. As some of you know, I called practically all the legislators prior to this session trying to find out what their priorities are and concerns were. This rose to the top of the list. In our community in Gallatin County, where we have staff around the state, this too is number one priority among grassroots activists throughout the state of Montana. I'm not talking Republican, I'm talking transpartisan. We've seen new people who've come out and be more active as a result of the restrictions that have been imposed upon them through unelected people who comprise city, county health boards. This bill makes perfect. In fact, not only are they unelected, they're pretty much immune from public input. In Gallatin County, we do no in-person meetings, despite the more recent lowering of the numbers of COVID and the lessening of the restrictions on our social gatherings. We only do Zoom events. Why? Because in August, when there was an outpouring of people in Gallatin County, the City County Health Board was ill-prepared to deal with those numbers, and now they simply take Zoom meetings. So they're not accountable to the people. This bill puts the local health boards under the accountability of the local governing body, which makes perfect sense, and they are accountable to us. Now, what the health board folks did and the officers did was permissible by Montana code, and I promised the people who were shut out from expressing their point of view that August that the way to make a difference is to change the laws, and that I would work to do that, and I've collaborated with this good representative and others in this legislative body, including Representative Matt Regeer, to help fashion and support this bill.
Mr. Kriegel, you're out of time, so thank you, sir.
You're welcome.
All right.
I would like to hand out a testimony by a young man who works here at the Capitol, whose parents also support the bill. If I might be able to do that, sir.
Good. Thank you. Mm-hmm. All right, next proponent, and 2 minutes for each. I should remind everybody as we go here, but 2 minutes for each proponent.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rachel Cohn, C-O-N-E, and I'm here today on behalf of the Montana Farm Bureau Federation. I would first just like to thank the sponsor for bringing this bill. This is important to our members and very timely because of the challenges they faced during this past year through the pandemic. This past year in the pandemic, local health officials having the unrestricted authority caused rural communities to shut down their business, and some of them were for indefinitely. And our members own, run, or work in some of these small businesses, and they've paid the price for that. Adding in this layer of elected officials to adopt the proposed rules, especially in the times of emergencies, can benefit these small businesses and rural communities. So for these reasons, and on behalf of our members, I'd ask the committee to support this bill.
Thank you. For the proponents.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Iverson with the Montana Tavern Association, I-V-E-R-S-O-N. Few, if any, businesses were more impacted by these public health orders than the tavern operators across the state of Montana, and so we support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. For the proponents.
Rhonda Wiggers, W-I-G-G-E-R-S, on behalf of the Montana Coin Machine Operators Association. And as we could not do curbside delivery, we were probably more impacted than all of the other businesses, even those that inside our tavern customers. And I also just want to note that this is an issue that we've been tracking for about 6 years. There are other, and this bill solves some of the concerns that we have had ongoing about this piece of legislation. We appreciate the work that the sponsor did and that the other people working on these bills did to bring you a good piece of legislation that everyone can work with, and we would hope that you will give it a due concur. Thank you.
Thank you. For the proponents. All right, we're done with proponents in the hallway. We'll go to proponents on Zoom.
If you wish to testify as a proponent for House Bill 121, raise your hand now, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Tim Burton, B-U-R-T-O-N, Executive Director of the Montana League of Cities and Towns. And I'll be very brief, Mr. Chairman. I also think it's tough to revamp the public health system in the middle of a pandemic, but I know a lot of work has gone into this bill. And for all the reasons that Mr. Bryson already testified, we're going to stand in support of House Bill 121. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Further proponents on Zoom.
That concludes all the proponents.
All right. We'll go to opponents. It doesn't look like there's any in the hallway. Are there any on Zoom?
If you wish to testify as an opponent, please indicate by raising your hand now. Mr. Biggins, as soon as you're ready, you can unmute and begin. I see you're off mute, but we can't seem to hear you.
Can I be heard now?
Yes, go ahead, sir.
Okay. Okay. To the Senate Business, Labor, and Economic Affairs Committee members, I speak in opposition to House Bill 121. As a simple retired citizen with a background as a former director of respiratory services in a Missoula hospital. Currently semi-retired, working with my wife in a small mom-and-pop upholstery shop in Sealy Lake. Public health decisions must be made on the basis of current science or guidelines from federal agencies such as the Center for Disease Control, National Institute of Health, National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, applicable to the issues at hand. Public health officials must operate independently at the local level in the best interests of Montanans, as outlined in current Montana law, and not be subject to the revisions of House Bill 121. Public health decisions made by current and future Montana local boards of health must not be subject to politicalization that House Bill 121 will bring. House Bill 121 can result in bad public health decisions for the people of Montana. The suggested revisions will not be in the best interest of public health. In summary, public health decisions must be made on the basis of science. Public health officials must operate independently at the local level as outlined in current Montana law. Suggested revisions in House Bill 121 will politicize public health decisions. Suggested revisions will not be in the best interest of public health for the citizens of Montana. Sincerely, Michael Biggins, B-I-G-G-I-N-S. Thank you.
Thank you. Further opponents on Zoom.
Last call for opponents. Please raise your hand. Okay, that concludes opponents, Mr. Chairman.
All right. It doesn't look like we had any informational witnesses in the hallway. Any on Zoom?
Chair Fitzpatrick and members of the committee, my name is Shannon Terrio. It's spelled T-H-E-R-R-I-A-U-L-T. And I am here as an informational witness on behalf of the Association of Montana Public Health Officials, the Montana Public Health Association, and the Montana Environmental Health Association, and can answer questions from the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, any additional informational witnesses? All right, we'll go to questions from the committee. Any questions from the committee? Sir Boland, did you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, actually, I just have a comment. Excuse me if I may. While I was sitting here listening to the testimony and some very powerful testimony it is, I happened to look up our Board of Health members in Great Falls, and I don't know if they're like this on everyone, but I just want you to know, in Great Falls, our makeup of our board are mostly elected officials. One is a mayor of Great Falls. One is the county commissioner of Great Falls. There's a citizen that is appointed by the county commissioner. There's an appointed citizen by the city of Great Falls. There's a licensed doctor of medicine on the board, and there's also a superintendent of schools that's on the board. So giving him a bad rap as not being a very good board and not accountable because they're not elected. I can see the Great Falls has good coverage on their Board of Health. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, since we're in question time, I guess I'll let the sponsor, if you want to respond to the comment / question, if you can wave off if you'd like.
For now, Mr. Chairman, I'll lay low and save it for my closing.
All right, the sponsor's waved off. Any further questions? Senator Gothier, did you have a question?
Mr. Chairman, committee members here, did we have somebody from the local health department testify as an...
We have an informational witness that could perhaps address the question if you've got...
I pass. Thank you.
I guess I'll ask a question of the sponsor just to make sure I'm understanding this bill.
Mr. Chairman.
So, Representative Beattie, just walk me through how this is going to work in a typical scenario. Let's just say there's an outbreak of a communicable disease. The health officer, as I understand it, could render decisions, and then those get appealed to the county commission. Is that or the elected or the governing board? Walk me through how this would have worked in the COVID world.
Chairman Fitzpatrick, the way this is set up to work is supposed to be simple and efficient. The first thing to note is, as you pointed out, in the event of an emergency or disaster, declared emergency or disaster, whether it's declared by the state or whether it's declared by the local at the local level, public health officials are free during that time to issue directives as they see fit. At any time thereafter, the local governing board that oversees that Board of Public Health can intervene to review such directives that are made.
And then, how is the power of the? Let me go back. So, the governing board can over. overlook the power? Does the power of the health board shut off at any time, or is this just a review period where things can change?
Senator Fitzpatrick, this is an open-ended review period. At any time, the local board can intervene. It can be the day after a directive is made. It can be 3 months after the directive is made. As they review the situation, as they weigh the other factors that that bear upon the emergency that's being that is in existence, and what my bill does is it simply provides the elective officials the opportunity to intervene. It doesn't have a set time schedule in it because I thought that to be too restrictive. Senator Fitzpatrick, I hope that I've answered your question, but I'd be happy to follow up again.
No, that does. Senator Gothier.
Mr. Chairman, this is for the bill sponsor.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gothier.
Thank you. In the crafting of this bill, which, by the way, is an excellent bill, thank you, I do have a question. Did you ever talk about the where the health department's imposing these rules onto the communities? And basically, there's a lot of businesses that suffered deeply from it, from their decisions. Did you ever look at the opportunity to maybe put their pay at half pay during a pandemic period so they can also feel the pain of what the communities have gone through the decisions they've made?
Senator Gauthier, that particular topic did not come up, but it is my understanding that most members of boards of public health aren't paid. The public health officers, on the other hand, are. But in point of fact, that was not considered.
Thank you.
Representative Beattie, let me ask you a question here. It looks like you had an amendment here that says allows a local board of health to adopt rules to implement a regulation adopted by a local government body. Explain the rationale for that amendment.
So if I understand, Senator or Chairman Fitzpatrick, could you repeat that section? I just want to make sure I'm answering your specific question.
Sure. I'm just reading here the title, and it looks like there was an amendment to the bill. It says that allowing a local board of health to adopt rules to implement a regulation adopted by a local governing body. I was just curious what that's for and why that's in there.
Yes. The reason I put that in there is, Chairman Fitzpatrick, that what I'm trying to draw here is a distinction between the promulgation of regulations, which my bill makes the province of the local elected officials. Currently, it resides with the Board of Public Health. So the establishment of regulations is done by elected body. The promulgation of rules is done by the agency, in this case, the Board of Public Health, that is executing those regulations. I'm trying to set up an analogous situation whereby, for example, the legislature establishes laws and the agencies make rules to carry out those laws. Now, I would further suggest that were I serving as an elected local official, I would craft my regulations in such a way that if I felt it was necessary for me to restrict rulemaking authority, I might do so.
Fair enough. Any further questions? Senator Pope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the sponsor real quick. Representative, thank you for bringing this bill. I wanted just to ask if you would mind putting in a little clarification on the comment that you made during your opening about a civil penalty versus a misdemeanor. I should know this, but would you mind just explaining to us the intent of that and what that means in a practical sense? Thank you.
Chairman Fitzpatrick, Senator Pope, the reason I placed that in there is it seemed a bit severe to subject people to misdemeanor offense for local violations of local rules. And so what I did in crafting this bill was not only in working with some stakeholders change this from a misdemeanor to a civil action, but also to define the venue in which such things would be decided.
Senator Pope, you're muted.
Can I have a quick follow-up on that?
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sponsor, would say a county commission felt necessary, would they be able to amplify if something was really egregious? Are there other avenues here to make infractions on important health issues, public health issues, a little bit more serious and a little more meaningful? I mean, or is that the end of the line by this bill? It's just a civil penalty and it'll never be anything more significant.
Chairman Fitzpatrick, Senator Pope, as I've put this bill together, and I just want to make sure I read back to the correct section of it, my intention was to remove, for violation of local rules and regulations, remove the misdemeanor designation. You'll see, though, that violations of state public health rules remains a misdemeanor.
Thank you, Mr. Sponsor, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, any further questions? All right, seeing none, the sponsor would like to close.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members of the committee, for a very good hearing. You know, we spoke about accountability here. I think that the fact is that boards are currently constituted, they may indeed have elected officials sitting upon them, but it is the official actions of elected bodies that matters in terms of accountability, and so. This is one of the primary reasons why I think House Bill 121 is so important. But, you know, as I worked through this bill, it quickly became evident to me that there's a larger issue looming over this matter that is of arguably more significance. You know, we live in a time when the legitimacy of our constitutional and political institutions is under attack. I think that's indisputable. I think House Bill 121 in part comes to the defense of our institutions by recalling this first principle. We elect fellow citizens to manage our government, and it is also then up to us to hold them accountable for doing the job. That this is the way our constitutional republic works. House Bill 121 defines the role of elected bodies in the public health arena. At the same time, it leaves intact the ability of our public health officials to enforce public health regulations and to respond to the immediacy of crises. I urge bipartisan support of the prudent policy expressed in House Bill 121. It strikes the right balance between the authority of local public health officials and the duty of local elected bodies. And with that, I close, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. This closes the hearing on House Bill 121. Representative, before you go, did you have a preference for a bill carrier?
If Senator Gauthier is available, I would be happy if he would carry this bill. Otherwise, I would look to the chairman. I would have done that first, but I thought he might gavel me out of here.
No, that's all right. Senator Gauthier loves carrying bills. All right, we'll close the hearing now on on House Bill 121. And if we have a sponsor, we'll go to House Bill 435.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members. I'm Bill Mercer. I represent House District 46 in the Magic City. And this morning, House Bill 435 is in front of you, and it's really designed as another piece to reopening the state and creating certainty for both governmental entities and really all of us that are stakeholders in this system to ensure that people acting prudently are not going to be subject to litigation. Skipping to, I guess, the title, we really are dealing with two different classes of entities in this bill, and it does follow in the footsteps of Senate Bill 65. But we're dealing in this bill with trying to create statutory immunity as allowed by the Constitution for governmental entities. So if you skip to Subsection 10, you'll note that this requires a two-thirds vote of the body. We got that on the House side and certainly hope that you can get it on the Senate side. And so if we leave the governmental entities for a minute, we'll also flag that Section 4 deals with liability of health care providers. That's the other piece of the bill. So there, Section 1 makes a number of definitions. Section 2 is really the guts of the bill that, except as provided in the Sections 3 through 6, that governmental entities are not liable for civil damages for injury or death from or relating to exposure or potential exposure to COVID-19 unless the civil action involves an act or omission that constitutes gross negligence, willful and wanton misconduct, or intentional tort. So that's the core principle of the bill. And then as you get into Section 3, there is a discussion of the fact that that standard does have exceptions. And the key language that I'd have you focus on is on lines 23 and 24, which notes that the civil action could still be brought if there was a burden met that either gross negligence, willful and wanton misconduct, or an intentional tort had been committed by the defendant. You'll note that in subsection 3 that this would apply to landlord-tenant claims. It also very clearly sets forth that a school district, if it has admitted students and up to 6 guests to an extracurricular event or graduation ceremony, that would be clearly stated as a permissible move by the district, and that it under no circumstances could that violate the standard that's set forth in that Section 3, subsection 1. And it also would immunize a school district or a unit of the university system that chooses to conduct an in-person instruction or extracurricular activities. Section 4 speaks to extending this same standard to healthcare providers. Once again, on the language in Section 4, lines 8 and 9, talks about this would not create immunity for any provider for which a standard of gross negligence, willful or wanton misconduct, or an intentional tort could be met. It talks specifically about what it applies to, and a good example of this would be injury or death resulting from screening, assessing, diagnosing, caring for, or treating individuals with a suspected or confirmed case of COVID-19. And if you look at those subsections 1 through 3 and all the subparts, it's really a focus on these providers, as we have heard throughout the session, have been laboring in a very difficult circumstance, and almost all the discussion we've heard talks about kind of the Herculean efforts that have been undertaken by those providers to do what they needed to do in the best way possible given the context in which they were faced. And going forward, we want to be able to have them make those same judgment calls, which are oftentimes going to be judgment calls, but that again, if the actions weren't acts or omissions that constituted gross negligence, willful or wanton misconduct, or intentional tort, they wouldn't be liable for essentially making those judgment calls, trying to allocate their resources in a way that makes sense given the context in which we are operating. Section 5 talks about affirmative defenses, and I guess I'd say that's legalese for saying we've already talked about raising the standard that would be necessary for someone to bring a case as a plaintiff. We also are creating 3 affirmative defenses here, which essentially say this is a further shield from liability if you, as the defendant, could demonstrate any of these things. So did the government take reasonable measures? And looking to what would constitute a reasonable measure, if the governmental entity complied with one of these sources of information, as you get into subsection 4, if there is a federal, state statute, a regulation, order, or public health guidance, if the entity can demonstrate that it complied with one of those and make that proof, that would be an affirmative defense for any sort of liability here. And as subsection 3 of section 5 says, that would be a complete bar to any sort of action if that proof could be demonstrated. There are limitations on requirements that otherwise might exist. So, for instance, a governmental entity is not required to ensure face masks are being used or face mask is sufficient to stop the spread of COVID-19. Governmental entity is not required to conduct a temperature check before allowing an individual to enter premises. And finally, an individual is not required to receive a vaccine, and a governmental entity is not required to ensure employees or agents are vaccinated to meet the standard of care. There is a savings clause in Section 8 which notes that this bill does not impact rights or duties that matured before the effective date of the bill, which would be at the time of passage and approval. So obviously, hopefully sometime in April. So, you know, to me, this is just a bill that helps create that footing that we all want to see. We all want to see institutions open back up. We want to return to normalcy. We want people to use good judgment, but we don't want them on the margins being so risk-averse that we can't try to make the transition that we need to make. And this is another piece that will help us do that. And as good as I think Senate Bill 65 was, I appreciate the fact that the chairman has been willing to partner on this issue, because I think we need to create that same sort of certainty for governmental entities. Otherwise, we're going to continue to have people make decisions that are going to hold us back, because that's what happens when you have to be overly risk-averse. This creates a little bit of a safe harbor for people to make those judgment calls that we need to try to get back to normal. I think you're going to hear from people that run school districts and certainly other governmental entities that they think this is a prudent step to help them do what they need to do as we get back on our feet. So with that, I'll sit down. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. All right, we'll go to proponents in the room.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Eric Bryson. That's B-R-Y-S-O-N. I'm here on behalf of the Montana Association of Counties. I'll be brief, Mr. Chair. The Montana Association of Counties also runs a property and liability insurance pool. And one of the first things that we were given notice of is our excess carrier, sometime before July of last year, noticed us that there was going to be no liability coverage for any communicable disease transmission for the entities that we insure. And think about the services that local governments provide, governments in general. You don't have a choice. If you pay your speeding ticket in justice court, you're going to come to justice court. If you want to pay your property taxes, there might be options to do it, but there's only one place to actually do it, to get your motor vehicle registration renewed, to go and do a preliminary plat application, to participate in a local government. You come to our facilities. And this bill, although it might not be perfect, and I'm not smart enough and I'm not an attorney to tell you if it actually provides the level of protection that we need, it provides an outline for some liability protection when you recognize that we're not a business. We are the place that oftentimes people have to and are forced to interact with. It's not a choice to come oftentimes to interact with your local government. So the liability protection contemplated in this bill is really important for us. I do hope it gets us somewhere back to some sense of normalcy, and I appreciate the sponsor's effort in addressing this the way that he has. So I do encourage your consideration for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, that looks like proponents in the room. Let's go to proponents on Zoom.
If you wish to testify as a proponent, please indicate by raising your hand on Zoom now, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Emily Dean, D-E-A-N, with the Montana School Boards Association. I'm also here today on behalf of the Montana Rural Education Association. I would direct you to a document sent by MREA Executive Director Dennis Perman yesterday for their specific testimony. First, just like to thank the sponsor for bringing this bill. It would limit school district liability for exposure to COVID-19. I think the sponsor did a good job of explaining the bill. We are particularly interested in noting Section 2 of the bill that provides for cases in which school districts would be liable, and this would not include those specific cases as described by the sponsor in Section 3. This bill would provide additional guideposts for school districts as we continue to manage school operations during this pandemic, and we appreciate these efforts. MTSBA and MREA would urge your support of HB 435. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any further proponents on Zoom?
Last call for proponents. Please raise your hand now. Okay, that concludes proponents.
All right, it doesn't look like there's any opponents in the room or the hallway, so we'll go to opponents on Zoom.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Al Smith, Montana Trial Lawyer Association. And we do oppose this bill. We think it's an unnecessary abrogation and limitation of Montana's constitutional rights under Article 2, Section 16 of the Montana Constitution. And it is an abrogation. That's why a two-thirds vote is required on this. You know, one of the things that you didn't hear from any of the proponents was a listing of just the torrent of lawsuits that have been filed against governmental entities and schools. Well, you didn't hear it because there haven't been. And the reason that it hasn't been is that these are very difficult cases to prove when it comes to personal injury, because you have to prove, you know, that the individual got the virus from that specific place. But here, and the other thing is why there haven't been any is because under our current liability laws, governmental entities are only required to do what is reasonable under the circumstances. Thus, you know, if they take reasonable steps, take responsibility to protect workers, customers, students, they're not going to face lawsuits, and they haven't. So one of the things I wanted to point out with this is that there's no definition of injury in this bill. Our statutes, though, at 27-1-106, defines injury as being of two kinds, to the person and to property. And an injury to property consists in depriving its owner of the benefit of it, which is done by taking, withholding, deteriorating, or destroying it. And every other injury is an injury to the person. So this bill covers injuries to persons as well as to property. Let me just go through a couple of sections on the bill. If you look at Section 2, page 2, line 14, now this pretty much says that governmental entities do not have to act reasonably. That's what the negligence standard is that you acted reasonably under the circumstances. This section says, no, you don't have to act reasonably and you're still going to get protections. So no negligence actions at all covered by this. And, you know, one of the reasons why, you know, we haven't seen this and what happens in a negligence action, we have to prove there was a duty owed to the plaintiff, that there was a breach of that duty, and that the injury was caused by that breach of duty, and that the damages were caused by the injury. With COVID, causation is very difficult to prove. Again, one of the reasons why you haven't seen, you know, a torrent of negligence suits. I mean, basically, if somebody came into one of my members' offices, a member would look, you know, listen to him and say, so you say you caught COVID at the high school. Did you visit any other public places in the 2 weeks prior to your COVID diagnosis? Did you gather with any family or friends, go to the grocery store, hardware store, hair salon, any other places? Oh, you did. Well, sorry, I can't take the case because we can't prove that you didn't get COVID from somewhere besides the high school. Very, very tough hurdle to get over on that part of it. Again, you know, looking at this, you know, this section allows deprivation of property rights without having to meet the negligence standard. I'd actually take a look at Section 3 on page 2. You know, that's labeled as duty of care. Well, read through subsection 1 there of new Section 3. Can you spot the duty? You can't, because there is no duty there. Why don't you go down to line 27 and it says the standard established in subsection 1 is not violated. Again, take a look at subsection 1. What standard? There is no standard set in subsection 1. If you take a look at new section 4, the healthcare providers, if you look on page 3, lines 15 through 16, you know, we talked a lot about, you know, that it was, you know, this is about COVID. That's lines 11 through 12. Lines 15 through 16 says, for any healthcare services unrelated to COVID-19. Okay? Again, it is reasonable under the circumstances. And here we're being, you know, just given blanket immunity for negligence. And if you look at lines 26 through line 1 of page 4, basically this is a get-out-of-court free card for any healthcare provider just by saying that anything that they did or didn't do was because of COVID, period. And no action can be taken against them. And then let's take a look on page 4, new section 5, the affirmative defense. And I'm glad the sponsor talked about this and saying that all a government entity would have to do is to meet one of those standards that are set out in subsection 1, lines 6 through 9. All they'd have to do is meet one of those. And then lines 13 through 14, they have a complete bar to any action. Complete bar means even gross negligence, even willful and wanton misconduct, even an intentional tort gets the benefit of this affirmative action or this affirmative defense if they've met one of those things in lines 6 through 9. That's just extraordinary. So it's not, you might as well just forget about, you know, saying that people that commit gross negligence or willful and wanton misconduct can still be held accountable. This section provides that they won't. If they followed one of those guidelines, as the sponsor said, and as the black and white statute or new proposed statute says here in new section 5, that's just outrageous. We can see an affirmative defense, you know, if on line 14 it after COVID-19 it said comma except those alleging gross negligence, willful and wanton misconduct or intentional tort, that might make some sense. But as is, the complete bar means exactly what it says. Complete bar. Doesn't matter if it's gross negligence. Doesn't matter if it's willful and wanton. That's just uncalled for. You know, we haven't heard any good reason why this should be enacted. Haven't heard of the, you know, huge onrush of cases. Any cases that would be brought for personal injury are going to be very difficult to prove, which is why there are so few that are ever brought. You know, I think it's time to step back from the hysteria and look at what actually has happened. And there hasn't been a glut of lawsuits. But what this bill does is it prevents anybody after the date of this act, after the date of effectiveness, from bringing a case, no matter what. You can't see the future. You can't determine what individual or what small business may have a valid action that this is going to prohibit. We would urge you to just vote no. Thank you.
Thank you. For their opponents.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Amanda Curtis, C-U-R-T-I-S. Good morning. I'm here as the elected president of MFPE, representing Montana's public employees and educators in communities all across the state. And while you've already heard from the management side of the labor-management relationship, I'm here to give an opposing view and raise some concerns on the labor side. I would draw your attention to the definition in section 1, number 6, item E of a state agency. Including a state agency in the list of sources of public health guidance is incredibly broad when you consider new section 5, item 2, allowing the choice between which source of health guidance to follow. I question whether or not this sets up an opportunity for employees in different agencies or government subunits to be treated differently, and what liability that might raise from a labor standpoint. I appreciate the intent of Section 2 and then the repeated wording in Section 3 to point out that this wouldn't be provided unless there was a willful act. However, in new Section 3, Item 3, the standard set that I've just referenced does not apply when school districts are providing in-person instruction, which is obviously problematic for us. New Section 3, Item 3, doesn't take into account at all building capacity, and so invites 6 guests for each student, regardless of how many folks that a building or stadium can hold. Let's see. In new Section 6, it says that the federal statute or public health guidance does not have to be followed. And I would just point out that in Section 6, Item 3, vaccinations are actually a mandatory subject of bargaining. So our members who are organized will be covered there already. And that about sums it up. I'm trying to be brief for you. Appreciate your listening to our concerns with the bill. Appreciate the intent here. I'll be around for questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Any further opponents on Zoom?
No, that concludes all opponents.
All right, I don't see any informational witnesses, and there's none on Zoom, is that correct? All right, questions from the committee? I guess I have a question for Ms. Curtis. Ms. Curtis, I guess I'm curious why you, as the representative of state employees, workers, would be opposed to legislation that limits the liability of the people you represent. I'm just a little curious about that.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. I can understand the confusion for sure. I'm here representing the employees of the state who are extremely concerned about getting COVID in their public-facing offices, but I do absolutely appreciate all of the different measures the state has taken to allow employees to work from home and to set up PPE and other protections from getting COVID.
But Ms. Curtis, let me follow up. The definition of a government entity is a state or political subdivision and includes employees of the state of Montana. So if one of your employees or one of the members of your organization were to be sued, this would make it more difficult for them, for a private party to sue them. I guess I'm curious why you, the representative of those people, would not support a bill that limits the liability of the members of your own organization.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that it's confusing. And again, I'm here representing employees who are worried about their employer not having to protect them at work.
All right. Any additional questions here?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Boland.
That's okay. Moving to the corner. No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question, for clarity, if I may, with the sponsor.
Ms. Chairman, Senator Boland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mercer, on page 4, section 5, I was listening to the comments from Mr. Smith. And I am kind of concerned about the complete bar, including willful and wanted and gross negligence. Can you respond to his assertion of what this is actually saying?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Boland. So the way that I hope the Senate considers this language is as follows. What we're saying is if you've got the government, and that could be the federal government, it could be the state government, it could be any of those entities as it's spelled out on line 8 of section 5 on page 4, if the government is saying you will have met your burden, your duty, if you do X, and if an employer, or in this case, if a governmental entity or anyone else covered by this bill does just that, we've essentially told them what they need to do and they do it, then we are saying you have acted responsibly in a way that you should not be held liable. Now, obviously, if they don't completely follow the guidance, the affirmative defense wouldn't apply. But the whole concept is if government is going to say, this is what you need to do to protect the public and essentially discharge your duties to people that are going to be coming into your facilities, and you do it, then it's impossible for you to have acted grossly negligent. Because you have complied with what the government told you to do in the first instance. So if that's not responsive, I'm happy to take another shot at it. But that's the whole intent of the affirmative defense section, is to say we want a governmental entity, for example, to be able to say if they get sued, what more could you ask of me? I knew what the government told me to do. I followed it to a T, and I should be immunized as a result of that.
Mr. Chairman, just a follow-up real quick, if I may.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mercer, I guess I don't quite understand why, if somebody, regardless of it's government or healthcare providers or the guy next door, does something that is willful and wanton or by gross negligence, that they wouldn't be held accountable. And you are saying that in the healthcare providers, that if they do something just really off the cuff and it's gross negligence, then they are held responsible. And yet you're giving affirmative defense to a public health official or a government, let's see, what is it, federal government, state, or public health guidance. I don't understand how the difference is between Section 4 saying there is coverage for willful and wanton, but there isn't in Section 5. Can you help me? Just let me understand it a little bit better. It just seems like if somebody does something really gross and negligent, they should be responsible for it, regardless of what entity it is.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Boland. So, I would take you back to the beginning of a lawsuit. So, if a plaintiff comes in and says, the following things happened, and I want the defendant to pay me damages because they had a duty, they breached the duty caused injury, and the injury needs to be compensated at this amount. The lawsuit would commence, and the individual defendant would be in a position to say, here's how I met my duty. An affirmative defense is something that can be asserted to say, this case should go away because the government told me what I needed to do to act responsibly in the pandemic. And as a result of what I did, I acted fully responsibly. And as a result, this lawsuit should go away. And so it is, I guess I would argue that without an affirmative defense, you're going to have the litigation commence. There's going to be discovery, et cetera. If the party comes in with an affirmative defense, they're going to assert that early on in the hope that they can say, because we fully complied with what the government told us we needed to do to meet, act responsibly in the pandemic, that should immunize us from this any sort of damages here. So that's the interaction between the two provisions.
Representative Mercer, sorry to jump in, Representative Boland, but let me just ask you a question. I want to follow up on this line, and I'll come back to you, Representative Boland, Senator Boland, if you have more questions. But if I'm reading this correctly, it says you took reasonable measures, so you're acting reasonably. Can you think of a scenario, Representative Mercer, where you're acting reasonably but at the same time acting intentionally? I mean, that seemed to be a disconnect here with what Mr. Smith is saying and I think the way the law works.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that's probably a better way to have answered the question, that if you have taken reasonable measures in response, it's going to be very hard for anyone to conclude that you have acted in a way that was grossly negligent or reckless or willful or wanton.
Senator Boland, did you have a follow-up?
Well, it's still not, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mercer, it's still not real clear to me, because even in Section 3, if you act reasonable, then you're off the hook. But if you act, you know, in wrongful, willful, wanton, and gross negligence, well, then you're liable. And I guess I'm done. I don't understand it. Thank you, Mr. Representative Mercer, for trying to explain it to me. And Mr. Chairman, thank you as well.
All right. Any further questions? All right, seeing none, the sponsor would like to close.
Very briefly, Mr. Chairman, I want to touch on some of the things that Mr. Smith said. So I agree that this would be something that would change what we typically know, that a case can be brought if an act of negligence is shown. But that's exactly why the Constitution says on a two-thirds vote the legislature can immunize state and local government, because there are circumstances in which the pure negligence standard is not going to advance the public interest. The public interest here is a balancing test between how do we empower the government to act responsibly. The whole bill is designed to say we're trying to induce the governments to act responsibly, but not to be in a way acting in such a risk-averse way that we can't ensure that the government's going to be opened back up. Same thing with healthcare providers. So the Constitution of the state of Montana specifically gives the legislature the ability to create that immunity, and that's what we're trying to do here. Mr. Smith has asserted that because there haven't been a lot of cases, that we should essentially just roll the dice on the assumption that that won't continue. I think what Mr. Bryson said, and certainly what we heard on the House side, is that there is uncertainty, and this bill will create the certainty that people will feel like they can not be overly risk averse. And so I think it is very important that we move forward in this regard. And to say that because there haven't been a lot of cases, there's no rational basis to act, I think is wrong. We need to sometimes act in a way that is preventative and is forward-looking and proactive, and that's what we're trying to do with this bill. Mr. Smith has asserted that there's no definition of injury and seemed to suggest that that was somehow a fatal flaw here. Obviously, injury is something that is dealt with in Title 27 of the Code. I don't believe there's any reason why we need to define that here. That is not a fatal flaw. On Section 3, he asserts that there's no standard of care, and I would encourage you to review that language. What it is specifically saying is we're revising the standard of care. We wouldn't be looking at just a situation in which negligence would be actionable. We're saying the standard of care would be there'd be no basis for a civil action unless there was an act or omission that constituted gross negligence, willful and wanton misconduct, or intentional tort on lines 23 and lines 24 of page 2. So I certainly believe there is a standard there. I think it's a standard that Mr. Smith doesn't want you to adopt. But I think to say that you can't find a standard in that subsection is not fair. Section 4, there was a discussion in Mr. Smith's dialogue on the subsection 3 in new section 4, where he was, and maybe it was in 5 as well, where he's essentially saying, if you look at 3, acts or omissions while providing health care to individuals with a condition unrelated to COVID-19, when those acts or omissions support the response to COVID-19,
He wants to characterize this as something that's going to completely alter the landscape of the responsibility of healthcare providers. And I would really encourage you to focus on that language in sub 3 and the language in E, which is part of that, which very clearly states, if the provider has had to reconfigure what it's doing as a direct response to COVID-19, perhaps it didn't get to an elective surgery as quickly as it might otherwise because of something COVID-related. This is trying to say, in an environment where we're trying to ensure that people can act responsibly, but they may have to actually triage, we can't hold them liable if, with their limited resources, they had to do X before they did Y. And I think the suggestion that this is going to somehow be a bar to medical malpractice cases is unfair, and I don't think it's correct. I think that what this is trying to do is say, if there is a tie to responding to COVID-19, that makes it essential to act in a particular way, we don't want healthcare providers to be paralyzed. And so I don't think the fear that has been represented here is reasonable. Finally, with respect to one of the arguments that Ms. Curtis made on page 2, the last line there about what if a school facility is very small, this appears to suggest that they can admit up to 6. Well, obviously, we have to trust our school administrators to make judgment calls. This doesn't say they have to admit 6. This simply says that they've got the authority to do that without facing liability. If the only thing that makes sense, given the size of the auditorium and the gymnasium, is something different, I'm confident that they'll exercise their discretion wisely. This, and just as if in an urban district, perhaps they would say, we can afford to allow 8 or 10 people to come. That doesn't mean they can't say 8 or 10 people can come. It only states that they are not going to face any liability risk for up to 6. So we have to trust the people on the ground to make rational decisions. This will allow them to be more forward-leaning in the decision-making process. It's going to help us turn the corner. I hope you give a favorable consideration. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. This closes the hearing on House Bill 435. And I think if we've got a sponsor, we'll go do House Bill 440. All right, we'll open the hearing on House Bill 440. Welcome, Representative Curdy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair Fitzpatrick and Senate Business and Labor members, for the record, I am Willis Curdy at CURDY, and I represent House District 98 on the west side of Missoula County. Today, I bring you House Bill 440, an act generally revising alcohol regulatory laws relating to wineries. House Bill 440 is a Montana agricultural production proposal. House Bill 440 simply requires that a winery located in license in Montana after the effective date of this act shall ferment at least 50% of the fermentable agricultural products that are used in wine production at that winery location. This is, if you want to look on page 2, lines 2 and 3, basically, that's the bill right there. So it defines what wineries are. Mr. Chair and committee members, I'll stand aside and let interested parties comment on the bill, and I reserve the right to close. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All right, we'll go to proponents for House Bill 440.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name's Carl Andrew Sponseller. I'm the general manager and the winemaker at Ten Spoon Vineyard and Winery in Missoula. My wife and I have been at it over there for since 1998. We have an 8-acre vineyard, and at our highest level of production, we did about 6,000 cases of wine. This bill is simply defining a production facility such as a winery. We do value-added manufacturing, and of course we're farmers. So that's the main thrust of this bill from our point of view, is to promote value-added manufacturing and made in Montana and agriculture, Montana agriculture. Now, we do buy some agricultural product from other states because that works well for us to have plenty of wine to make at our winery. But the 51% is about fermentation, and we think that's a fair amount to require so that wineries actually are engaged in the business of manufacturing. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. We take questions later.
Okay.
All right. For the proponents.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brandon Skarsten, Skarsten. I'm the operations manager, sales manager, and my wife and I are future owners of Yellowstone Cellars and Winery in Billings, Montana, which has been open since about 2010. I strongly support House Bill 440. The bill would level the playing field for all future winery operations in Montana by requiring wineries to produce at least 50% of the wine that they sell on premise by fermentation. In any given year, we probably harvest about 100,000 pounds of grapes from Yakima, Washington. We drive 13 hours from Billings to Yakima and 13 hours back to Billings 6 to 8 times a year. We crush, we ferment, we barrel age. We do everything in-house. We produce somewhere around 30,000 bottles of wine a year. I tell you this because in hopes that you'd understand how much work goes into actually producing wine in Montana. There's been a loophole of sorts for wineries in Montana from the start with the way the law is currently written. There's been no true definition of what a winery is. The loophole allows out-of-state wineries to apply for Montana winery licenses, set a business in Montana, import and sell bulk pre-made wine, or purchase wine that's already in bottles without labels. All of this happens without these wineries producing or fermenting a drop of wine. These fake wineries, which we've kind of come to call these guys, they compete against other wineries who ferment and who have the burden of tens of thousands of dollars worth of equipment, labor costs, everything else. These fake wineries also, unfortunately, compete with bars and taverns and tap rooms and other fully licensed establishments in Montana that serve alcohol. A winery that doesn't produce their own wine, my feeling is like a dairy farmer who doesn't milk his own cows, or a brewery who doesn't actually brew their own beer. I urge you all to pass House Bill 440. It finally provides a clear definition of what a winery is in Montana, and it allows Montana winemakers to operate in a fair commercial marketplace. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. For the proponents.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Iverson with the Montana Tavern Association, IVERSON. I want to echo the comments that have been stated thus far and just give you a little bit of extra information. So what we learned is there's a couple wineries in Montana. We believe more are looking to come into Montana, and they bring in wine two ways. The first is called Shiners, and that's an industry term. You can Google it. And they're called Shiners because they are a wine bottle that's filled and corked, but it's shiny because it doesn't have a label on it. So they bring it into Montana, they place their label on it, and they say it's their wine, and then they serve it under their winery sample room license. So this would be no different than a Montana craft brewery actually not making any beer, not buying any barley, just going down to Anheuser-Busch there in Colorado, having them make all their beer and bring it up to Montana and then call themselves a brewery and operate under a brewery license. No one would find that acceptable, and we don't find it acceptable with wineries either. And so that was the issue. Another way they bring it in, it's called totes. Totes are 4-foot by 4-foot by 4-foot poly tanks, sit on a pallet. It's another way they bring wine in. So there the wineries are bringing in pre-made wine. All they're doing is bottling it, corking it, and then calling themselves a winery. This bill sets a very low standard for people to hit. It's a very low standard. You've got to ferment 50% of the wine you make. And so we're still giving a lot of flexibility, the sponsor is really giving a lot of flexibility here. We're supporting this bill because it it starts to solve, it stops the problem from growing, and the problem being these fake wineries. And I'll point out on the key language in the bill is page 2, lines 2 through 4. That's where the limit comes in. And then another key thing to point out is on the final page, page 4, lines 1 and 2. So there is a grandfather. So anyone that's come into the business, they can stay in business. But on a going forward basis, if you're going to get a winery license in Montana, you got to make some wine. So with that, we support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Further proponents? Doesn't look like there's any additional ones. Any on Zoom? None on Zoom. Doesn't look like there's any opponents. None on Zoom, correct? All right. And no informational witnesses and none on Zoom. All right. Questions from the committee?
Actually, there is one information.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. This is Steve Swanson, excuse me, SWANSON with the Montana Department of Revenue's Alcoholic Beverage Control Division. I'm here for questions. Thanks.
Thank you. All right. Any additional informational witnesses? All right. Questions from the committee? Senator Gothier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is for Mr. Skardiskin, was it?
Mr. Chair.
Thank you for coming today, and I'm not a winer or winery. I like to drink the wine, but trying to understand the 50% portion of this thing, I understand that 50% of this wine has to be, you buy your grapes from Yakima and you bring more of them, you actually crush it and turn it in and ferment it and make it into wine. So I get that part of it, and that's what makes a Montana winery, right? Officially a Montana wine, right? So what do you do with the other 50? So what are you talking about with the other 50%? Is that wine crushed and brought in from another state? I'm trying to understand that other 50%.
Mr. Chair, Senator Guth here. What we do at Yellowstone Cellars, I can't speak for everybody, but what we do at Yellowstone Cellars, we purchase roughly about 75% of the wine that we produce. 75% of that is grapes that we purchase and buy from Yakima. When we go over there and we transport them back, that's all of our red grapes. We ferment, we crush, we barrel age, we do all of that in-house. For our white wines, we purchase those white wines. We have them co-manufactured or contract manufactured in Yakima simply because we just don't have any more time, the space, or the equipment to make white wines. So what this bill is essentially allowing us to do is still bring in roughly 25% of our wines pre-made. Once we get them to the winery, we still blend, we still bottle, we still label, any number of things that we're doing. But what it's essentially allowing is for that flexibility. And if we need to bring in wine, that we can do that along with what we're producing.
Follow up.
Okay, I'm just another clarification. I buy a lot of wine, and sometimes it's like a blend. They call it blend. Would you have like 50% of your in-state wine, and then you'd blend with another out-of-state wine? Would that be considered a blend? Is that something you guys do?
With blended wines, with like a red blend, I mean, it can be just two different varietals or three different varietals. It could be... I guess it could be wine that we are making from grapes and maybe possibly wine that we're bringing in. In our case, we don't do that, but I guess this bill would allow for that. I'm sorry, yeah, I'm not sure if that answered your question.
I'm just curious, winery guy here,
Yeah.
All right, that's all I got, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Boland.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. How about for the sponsor, please?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Curdy. I'm just curious, on page 2, line 13, that you had 6,000 cases and then went back to the 4,500. Can you tell me why? Being that the one of the proponents did say they made like 6,000 cases at their highest production.
Mr. Chair, Senator Boland, there were a number of amendments made to this bill, and we chose to go back to the original number that had been established years ago, and that's the reason why we decided to do that. It's just like if you make an example Some of the breweries now in Montana are limited, let's say, before be under federal law, like 60,000 barrels or the like. We set those standards and saying, okay, this is the limit that you can produce, and if you follow on down through here, that wine, that up to that limit, can be shipped and delivered the wineries to a retailer. So that's a limit that can be shipped to a retailer or with a common carrier to another retailer, or shipped and delivered by the directly from the producer's winery to a bonded warehouse. So that's a limit. That's a self-imposed limit that the industry put on themselves years ago. And when, you know, to kind of elaborate a little bit, this bill got its birth in the House Ag Committee, and the bill in the House Ag Committee had a lot of problems with it. The bill was tabled. I took some of the parts of the bill, redrafted it, brought it up to House Business and Labor, and again we decided in those amendments to remove the 6,000 because we felt that was maybe too much, without, you know, like, how should I say it again, meeting that threshold. I think, am I clear? Because yes. Only a certain amount can go through this process. And we didn't want to expand beyond that point. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Perfect. I appreciate it. I just was curious. Thank you very much, Representative and Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
All right. Any further questions, Senator Pope?
Yeah, for the sponsor, Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Curdy, welcome to Senate Business and Labor. I wanted to quickly ask, on page 3, I should know this, but just to clarify, Section 2 was amended initially, and then it's been ruled out, that whole section. That is that the when you had amendments and then you put it back, certain amendments and whatnot? Is that being struck from statute, or is that just on the bill to show that it was once meant to be amended, but now we have a new Section 2? Can you just describe, because it talked about hard cider and stuff. I'm just curious.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pope, so wineries, cideries are also included with wineries in the law. And so that was a part of that was taken out of here, and there was a feeling that there wasn't any need for this language in this bill. So the reason why it went down to Section 2 is just to keep in mind that from the day if this bill gets to the governor's desk and signed, or when it does, hopefully, when it's signed, that the new law comes into effect, and so you now have to meet the other criteria of at least 50% fermented in Montana.
And I, Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up.
Yeah.
Representative Curdy, so one would expect that if the hard cider folks had any problems with this, that they would have been in today's conversation. So I'm just making sure.
Yeah. So, Mr. Chair, Senator Pope, in the House hearing, some language, as you will note, on page 2, lines 5 through 9, were included in that bill, and the cideries did come in and oppose this bill. So in the amendment that was made, we took out lines 5 through 9, and that the cideries from that point on were okay with this bill. And of course, today, none of the cideries have shown up to object to the bill. So we've worked with them, and everybody's okay with the cideries.
Hey, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Gothard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is for the informational witness, Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gauthier.
Yeah, I just from a perspective from the state agency overlooking all these wineries in the state of Montana, how do you, first, there's a quantity on cases of like 4,500 cases that they can produce a year. But how are you as an agency oversee that and make sure those policies are not being abused? What do you do?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gauthier, thank you for the question. The 4,500 case requirement that's in that bill is not how much they can produce within a year. That's just a quantity of how much they can self-distribute to retailers. So my understanding is that on our tax returns, we ask certain questions, and I believe that's one of them, and I could certainly confirm for you, reporting how much wine the winery self-distributed to the retailer, because they're responsible for paying the tax on that wine that they self-distribute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, any further questions? Senator Sweeney.
Mr. Chair, question for Carl. I didn't catch your last name.
That's my first question.
Yes, Representative Sweeney.
What was your last name, Carl? Sorry.
Oh, it's Sponseller. It's Sponseller.
Thank you, Mr. Sponseller. How many wineries, and I don't know if this was brought up, are there in Montana that would fit this category right now? I know I've been to yours and to the Tongue River one in Miles City.
Active winemakers. I don't know. Half a dozen at the most, maybe.
Okay.
And there's just an awful lot of wineries that started out buying bulk wine, and they essentially became a repackager or a retailer or a wholesaler. They weren't really a winery. And I understand that those people will retain their license and that from, like Representative Curdy said, that after the bill is signed into law, then that won't happen anymore. Being able to use your winery license for a retail or a wholesale license. Now, to be clear, almost in every state in the union, some wholesale and some retail ability is allotted to producers of spirits, beer and wine, to make their operations viable. But we're primarily a manufacturer, and we think a manufacturer's license should be for manufacturers.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Just you said you, I think, 1,000 or 6,000 cases.
We did at the peak of our experience, and 6,000 would be 72,000 bottles of wine. And I worked on the bottling line with my crews and had the calluses to prove it. So. But it's an interesting business to be in, because everybody thinks they can make money at the alcohol business, and it's a little bit of a different picture once you actually get there. It's just like anything else, yeah.
Well, all right, any further questions? All right, would the sponsor like to close?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Thank you for some great questions. As we mentioned earlier, House Bill 440 sets parameters for wine production and tasting room operations. House Bill 440 is designed to expand the growth of grape production and establishes requirements for the sale and transport of bottled wine from the winery. And as mentioned earlier, and I want to make this clear, that the bill grandfathers in wineries who currently hold a license prior to passage and approval of this act. We do not want to cut those people who are already licensed in the state off at the knees. They were here doing business. We think they should continue to do business, but from henceforth, we are really trying to push growing grapes in the state of Montana. And our family, personally, our my sister and I farm in the Bitterroot, and right next to us is an MSU ag research station, and their one of their main functions is developing grapes that can be grown here in Montana, and we honestly think that. Due to that, we're going to see a significant increase in wine production in Montana. So this helps set the stage for that to happen. And finally, there's one thing I want to mention, and there was some criticism from some folks that the Montana Tavern Association was behind writing this bill. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I wrote this bill with assistance from Representative Buttrey, who included the amendments that you see that strikeouts in this bill. So that was not something that came from the MTA. It is my creation, and working with wineries like Mr. Sponseller and Mr. Beck from Billings in producing this document. So, members, I'd appreciate a due pass on House Bill 440. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, this closes the hearing on House Bill 440. And if we've got a sponsor, we'll do House Bill 510.
Senator Sweeney, would carry the bill.
Senator Sweeney, fine, great. So we'll be the carrier for this bill. All right, committee will be in recess for a few minutes while we wait to find a sponsor.
All right, committee, we don't have a sponsor, so we're going to call it good for the day. Anything further? One record thing. We'll be back on Monday. We're going to come in at 11:15, and we will just do executive action. So what we'll do is we'll come, we'll gavel in, and we'll do. I'll read the bills off, take a break, and then we'll come back and finish our executive action. So Monday, 11:15, and it will strictly be for executive action. So unless anybody has anything further, we are adjourned. Thank you, everybody.